I'm very pleased then, just as we get started this morning, to welcome Mr. Robert Preston, who comes to us with a lifetime of experience in public service and who has given much thought and reflection to this issue. Robert is a busy man. He's telling me that he just came from the Scottish Parliament this week, where he was helping them to think through these issues. Robert is director of the Living and Dying Well Institute, which provides resources in this whole area. And I would ask you that you would give him a good, warm welcome as he comes to speak to us. Thank you, Robert.
Morning. When we discuss living and dying well, a key and topical aspect is the proposals which are currently before the Westminster and Holyrood Parliaments and which you are mercifully spared. I mean, I can think, as I was saying to Stafford, I can think of a 100 good reasons to live here, but an additional one is that you're spared this particular threat. That there are proposals there to change the law, to legalise what is euphemistically being called assisted dying. And what I'd like to do in the next half hour or so is take you through the many aspects of this and explain it on the basis of evidence. Living and Dying Well is not a campaigning group, it is a think tank. But it is a think tank with a position. We don't simply slope shoulders and say, well, we don't know which way you should jump on this one. We've examined the evidence carefully, the hard evidence, and it is our view that the law should not be changed. You simply cannot make a sustainable case for changing the law. And that's what I'd like to take you through today. This is a multidimensional issue. I've got to watch this. A very important part of it is the law. You have to understand what the law says and how it's applied. Public safety, very important part of this. There's clinical practice, and Baroness Finlay will go into that in considerable depth, and she knows far more about it than I do, as I think she's the second speaker. There's a question of mental health. If you're going to make a decision to seek lethal drugs from a doctor, you need to know what you're doing. Mental health is a very important part of this. There's the question of society. How, as a society, do we view suicide? What are we to make of all these opinion polls that say people want the law to be changed? There's the question of disability. The laws that we're seeing, the bills that we're seeing in the two parliaments, are not actually aimed at people specifically with disabilities. But there is.
Having a few issues with people hearing you, so we're going to.
Oh yes, that would be splendid. You bear with me, ma'am.
Is this from your pocket?
Yep. Okay. Do you want to clip this in somewhere?
Yep. Just from your pocket. Or
well,
on
oh
your
yes.
Belt,
then. Yes. I much prefer these. There we are. Okay. I'll put this on.
Your slides are in front of you as well.
Oh, they're in front of me as well. Excellent, that's marvellous.
Okay.
Thank you.
So just on the other side.
That's fine. Can you hear me now? Hello? Can you hear me?
Once he gets to the back.
Ah, once he gets to the back. Okay.
You need to review your slides, Robert. What happened was you pressed the thing that you were putting on your microphone.
So you're too far. Right. Right. You can hear me now?
Yes.
Excellent, excellent, loud and clear. That's very good. And I can read my slides here. Okay, now, we're some way ahead. Wait a minute. How did we get there? I won't be a second. Ah, that way. Yeah. That's it. Right. They're not. The bills that we're seeing are not aimed specifically at people with disabilities, but there's a very fine line between serious illness and disability. And a lot of disabled groups are very concerned about a change in the law. We have to look at international experience. Half a dozen or so jurisdictions around the world have chosen to go down this road and to legalise either assisted suicide or administered euthanasia. What's been their experience? Has it worked or has it not? And then there's the ethical dimension. The ethical dimension can include the religious dimension, or it may not. Whoops, I'm going too fast. So what is the law, first of all? Now, the law in Northern Ireland is the Criminal Justice Northern Ireland Act 1966. It is virtually identical with the law in England and Wales. The law in England and Wales is the Suicide Act of 1961. Interestingly, Scotland doesn't have a ban on assisting suicide. This is one of the complications of changing the law in Scotland, because there isn't technically a law to change. But Northern Ireland is the same as England and Wales for this purpose. Basically, what the law says is that it is not against the law to attempt to commit suicide, or indeed to commit suicide, but if you commit suicide, you can't be prosecuted. But it's not against the law to attempt to commit suicide, but it is against the law to encourage or assist somebody else to commit suicide. And if you are convicted of doing so, you are liable on conviction to a maximum sentence of 14 years imprisonment. Oops, it keeps doing two. So how does the law link with society? What are social attitudes to suicide? How do we regard suicide as a society? As a society, we treat people who attempt suicide with understanding and compassion. But we do not, as a society, regard suicide as something to be aided and abetted, as something to be encouraged or assisted. That's what all the suicide watches are about. In prisons, for example, where people are considered to be at risk of self-harm. That's what the suicide prevention strategies are about that successive governments have introduced. That's what all the attempts that are made to revive people who attempt suicide are about. They're about the fact that society may treat people who attempt suicide compassionately, but it doesn't want to encourage the practice and it doesn't want to assist it. Now, the law here is completely in line with social attitudes. If you change the law to license assisting suicide for certain groups of people, you're stepping out of that consensus. There we are. But, now this is what the campaigners say. This is what the campaigners for legal change say. They say, ah yes, but it's not suicide if you assist someone who is already dying to hasten their death. Now, it's an interesting question. They say, no, assisted dying is not the same thing as assisted suicide because the person is already dying. Well, here we come across the use of language. If a person ends his or her own life, that is suicide. If you assist a person to end his or her own life, you are assisting a suicide, whether you are a doctor or anyone else. The fact that the lethal drugs come from a doctor's prescription does not change the definition. It is still assisting suicide. And you have to look at discriminatory attitudes here. If you say that people who are dying have a right to have lethal drugs from their doctors to help them to end their life, you can interpret that two ways. The campaigners would say you're giving them a benefit. You're giving them a benefit to take their leave of this life. But there's another way of looking at it. You're actually saying they deserve less protection from the law than the rest of us do. The law is not there to hinder us. The law is there to protect us. It's there to protect vulnerable people. If you say people who are seriously ill should have the right to have lethal drugs from their doctors so they can end their lives, you're saying, in effect, that a different standard of protection should apply to them than applies to the rest of us. Well, what about exceptional cases? What about the cases of somebody who is in agony and wants to die? Should they not be assisted in some way? Well, there's a famous story, and I don't know whether it's true or whether it's apocryphal, but I'll tell it to you nonetheless, which illustrates this perfectly. It's known as the policeman's dilemma. About 70 or 80 years ago, on a lonely interstate highway in the United States, a petrol tanker skidded and overturned, and the driver was trapped in his cab, and the petrol was leaking onto the engine block. And a highway patrolman arrived. He was the only person on the scene. There was no chance of getting rescue services or ambulance services there within even half an hour. And the highway patrolman got out of his car and he ran out and he saw the man trapped in his cab, and the man could see it was going to go up in flames. He said, "For goodness sake, shoot me. I don't want to be burned to death." And the question that is posed, the policeman shot him, by the way. The question that is posed is, was the policeman right to shoot him? Now think about that question. A select committee of the House of Lords, on which Baroness Finlay sat and which I was the clerk 10 years ago, repeatedly asked this question of witness after witness. Was the policeman right to shoot the man? And nobody can answer the question. There's a lot of shilly-shallying. Oh, well, maybe, and so on and so forth. And then one man came forward. He was a cleric. He was an Anglican. And he said, yes, he was right. And you could feel the shock horror in the public gallery. And he said, actually, I hope you would too. There's even more shock horror. I have to, man with a clerical collar saying this. But he said, I wouldn't change the law to legalize it. That is the crucial question here. That there are all sorts of things which any of us might do in extremis. I cannot guarantee to you that I would not assist someone to end their life in extreme circumstances. I don't think any of you can, if you're really honest with yourselves. But that is a different matter from creating a licensing system for setting it up by law. How does the law actually work? I've told you what the law is, but you need to know how it works. You need to understand there are two concepts. There's illegality and there's criminality. If you break the law, you do not necessarily do that. You're not necessarily criminal if you break the law. For to be criminal, you have to break the law in a way that deserves prosecution. That's what the word criminal means. The law on assisting suicide covers a wide spectrum of criminality. At one end of the spectrum, it covers the case of someone who assists a loved relative out of this life. After constant pleading, the relative is suffering terribly. The relative is completely sound. The person who gives the assistance does it very reluctantly. That's at one end of the spectrum. At the other end, you've got the malicious relative who wants to get the hands on an inheritance, or who's tired of a care burden, who wants to help somebody out of this life maliciously for their own gain. There is a wide... If you assist a suicide, you could be anywhere inside that spectrum. And the law recognises this. It therefore gives the prosecutors discretion. It gives the prosecutors the discretion to look at every case on its merits, and only to authorise a prosecution if the head of the prosecution says so. That is the same in Northern Ireland as it is in England and Wales. There are prosecuting policies in place that set out the sort of circumstances which might incline against a prosecution and that might incline in favour of a prosecution. For example, just to give you examples, if the person you assisted had not expressed a clear wish that they wanted to die, that's an obvious aggravating factor. On the other side, that the person you assisted was of completely sound mind and had a settled wish for a long time. That's a mitigating factor. It doesn't mean you won't be prosecuted, it's a mitigating factor. One of the aggravating factors, and I'm sure that Ilora Finley will deal with this, is that assistance given by a doctor or a nurse to a patient under his or her care is an aggravating factor, because it is seen as a breach of doctor-patient trust. But the law is not automatic. We're often told, if you assist a suicide, the law is terribly cruel, it will send you to prison for 14 years. No, it won't. If you assist a suicide, the head of the prosecution service will look at all the evidence after a police investigation. What exactly happened? Was this person serious? Was there reluctance? Was it really compassionate or was it malicious? And a judgment is made. So what's the result? Does it work? Assisting suicide is a rare offence. I can only speak for England and Wales here, but there are less than 20 cases a year that come across the desk of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Less than 20 cases a year. And very few of those are prosecuted. Now, of course, those who want to change the law say, well, that means the law isn't working. If they're not prosecuting, that means the prosecutors are afraid to change the law. No, it doesn't mean that at all. There is something called deterrence here. The law has what has been called a stern face, but an understanding heart. The law says you will not aid and abet someone's suicide, and if you do, you're running the risk of going to prison. But it also has the discretion to say, if you do, we'll look at the circumstances and see just what those circumstances were. The last Director of Public Prosecutions for England and Wales, Keir Starmer QC, put it this way. He said this to Lord Falconer's so-called Commission on Assisted Dying. He said, the law works well in practice. It is a law with a stern face, but an understanding heart. Now, the campaigners have another answer to this. They say, that's all very well, investigating a case after it's happened and deciding whether to prosecute. But that's all too late. The person's dead by then. What we should have is an investigating system before someone dies. In other words, you should go to your doctor and he should go to another doctor and they should examine you and decide whether you're being coerced and decide whether you've got a settled intent and whether you're mentally capable. In that way, it's all out in the open beforehand. But actually, they're comparing apples with oranges here. Because what you get with an assisted suicide law is subjective opinion. You go to a doctor and say, I want you to give me lethal drugs because I think I meet these conditions, A, B, C, and D. And he says, yes, I think you do. And another doctor says, yes, I think you do. But it is based entirely on subjective opinion. And I have to ask you this, how many of you know your doctors? How many of you have doctors who know you really well? My GP, I've been with him for 15 years, has never visited my home. Mind you, I haven't been terribly ill, to be fair. But he's never visited my home. If I went and demanded assisted suicide, I don't think he'd know where to start in assessing me. But since 80% of doctors are against this, the chances are that if you went to your doctor and said, under this law, I want lethal drugs to end my life, you've 4 out of 5 chance your doctor would say, I'm sorry, I'm not doing it. You'll have to find a doctor who's willing to do it, and that will be a doctor who would know absolutely nothing about you whatever. So what we're talking about here, you see, is subjective opinion, whereas at the moment we have a system which rests on objective evidence from a police investigation. It's not perfect, but it is evidence-based. And then there's the deterrent factor. If you change the law, you remove the deterrent factor. Take as an example, I go to my doctor. I'm terminally ill, and I manage to persuade him that I'm of sound mind, I'm not being coerced, it's a settled wish, and another doctor agrees with that, and I get the drugs. I'm then vulnerable, because anybody could coerce me into taking those drugs and they wouldn't be investigated, because I'd already been through an investigating process. You remove the deterrent factor. Now, what others say about this. This is what the Director of Public Prosecution said about the law. He said there is residual discretion for all offences, whether to prosecute or not. This is a particular version of it, but it's not unique by any stretch of the imagination. It's the way our law operates. It's not just this law that operates like this. If you drive through Belfast at 60 miles an hour, you will not necessarily be prosecuted. Please don't go out and do this and say I said so. But it depends on the motive. If you were rushing a desperately sick child to hospital, I'm doubtful you'd be prosecuted. If you did it for the hell of it, you probably would be. But you see, you know, laws are like this. You know, the laws on theft are all the same. If you get up in the night and find a burglar, and the burglar is threatening your family, and to defend your family, you injure the burglar, well, that's injury. Injury is a criminal offence. Will you be prosecuted? It depends on the circumstances. So, you know, laws have to be interpreted. There is criminality as well as legality. And then let's look at Northern Ireland peer Baroness O'Neill as well. This is what she told Lord Falconer's so-called Commission on Assisted Dying. She said, the law is far more than an enabler of prosecutions and convictions. It is also a symbolic system, an indication that we're protecting people. Laws are not just regulatory instruments. They send messages. If you make a law that says, if you're terminally ill, you may apply for assisted suicide. You're sending the message, if you're terminally ill, perhaps this is the sort of thing you ought to be thinking about. Now, for some people who are very strong-minded, very strong-willed, that might do no harm. But, you know, most people are not like that. Baroness Finlay, who's had more experience than just about anybody I can imagine caring for dying people, will tell you, I'm sure, that a terminal prognosis knocks you sideways. People who are terminally ill can be vulnerable. They can roller coaster from hope to despair and back again. All right, safeguards. This is the other thing we're told. Don't worry, there'll be safeguards. The bills that we've got in Scotland and England and Wales, they say, right, you have to have a settled intent. It has to be a voluntary request. It has to be a fully informed decision. You must know all the facts about your medical condition. You must be free from pressure or coercion of any kind, and you must have the mental capacity to make the decision. Well, that sounds absolutely fine. But when you say to the sponsors of the bill, how is a doctor to establish that these conditions apply? Oh, that's something we'll deal with later in codes of practice. Parliament both in Scotland and in London, is being asked to sign a blank check. It is being asked to approve legalisation of assisted suicide on the basis that these ideals will be met, but no processes are prescribed in the bills to make sure that they are met. So there are technically no safeguards. I'm going to speak very little about clinical practice because I don't want to steal Baroness Finlay's thunder, not that I feel I ever would do. But the question we have to ask is, assisted suicide is one thing, but why does it have to be physician-assisted suicide? Why are we talking about licensing doctors to supply lethal drugs? I mean, you know, supplying lethal drugs to patients is not something that doctors are there for. This is what the Royal College of Physicians said in 2009. When the Director of Public Prosecutions was preparing his prosecution policy, he had a consultation exercise. And this is what the Royal College of Physicians wrote to him. They said, "We believe that our duty of care is to work with patients to mitigate their and overcome their clinical difficulties and suffering. It is clear to us that this does not include being in any way part of their suicide." The Royal College of General Practitioners recently had a survey of its members. 77% of GPs who responded said, "You should not change the law." The Royal College of Physicians has recently had another survey, a similar majority, saying you should not change the law. The British Medical Association, of which Baroness Finlay is president, has said repeatedly in its annual conference, you should not change the law. And yet we're being faced not with assisted suicide, but with physician-assisted suicide. Mental health. Anyone will say, of course, if you're going to end your life, you must know what you're doing, if you're going to do it legally. But suicidal intent is normally regarded as grounds for psychiatric investigation. If I go to my doctor and I say things to him that suggest that I might be going to take my own life, he'll refer me to a psychiatrist. In extreme circumstances, he might have me sectioned. And yet, under these proposals, if you go to your doctor and say, "I want your assistance to help me to commit suicide," that is not considered to be grounds for psychiatric assessment. There is no provision in these bills for a psychiatrist to examine your mental state. And it's not just a question of being compos mentis. That's quite easy to establish. You've got to look at conditions that might impair your judgment when making decisions. And a major one is depression. It is no surprise that people who are terminally ill are often depressed. I would be if I were terminally ill. If you look at the experience of Oregon, which is one of three states in America which have legalized these practices, research was carried out 6 or 7 years ago. It was published in the BMJ. And it showed that of a sample of cases of people who had ended their lives with legally supplied lethal drugs, 1 in 6 had actually shown signs of clinical depression, which the doctors who assessed them had failed to see. Now, that might be an untypical sample. It was a fairly small sample. Maybe a bigger sample would show the problem wasn't so big, or it may show it was even bigger. But the evidence we've got is worrying. And then there's the effect of medication. Medication for various states can actually affect your judgment. It can affect the way you think. Now, society, this is the big one. The big claim of those who want to change the law is that society wants it. Opinion polls. 80% of people were told want to see the law changed so that somebody who is seriously ill, terminally ill, can have an opportunity to end their life. Now, just what's going on here? What lies behind the polls? Understanding the subject. It's a very complex subject. A lot of the reactions to it are knee-jerk reactions. Media reporting plays a big part. Most of us lead busy lives. I know I do, and I'm sure you do. I've got opinions on all kinds of things. I've got opinions on the Arab Spring, the world economy, global warming. Where have I got them from? If I'm really honest, I've got them from what I've read in the press or heard and seen on radio and TV. They are opinions that have been suggested to me. And so it is with this subject, that the media will tend to report the exceptional case. 1 in 25,000 deaths of Britons has taken place at the suicide facility in Switzerland. 1 in 25,000 deaths over the last year. Everyone makes the headlines. The late Bernard Levin had a splendid article in the Times some years ago. Those of you who are perhaps a little less older than than me will remember Bernard Levin's, the younger ones won't. He's a brilliant journalist, I think. And he said if a Martian landed on this Earth and all he had to tell him about what it was like here was the news, he'd be horrified. He said, there are tsunamis every day. Bombs are always going off. I mean, actually, people used to talk like this about Belfast, I remember, actually, in the 1970s. You know, they said, that's what it's like. No, it isn't like that at all. And, you know, planes always crash. Slightly sick joke after our experience last night. But he said, if all he had to guide him was the advertisements, he'd get a totally different picture. He'd say, yes, all holidays are happy. The sun is always shining. Nobody ever has any accidents. He said they're both wrong. But he said the advertisements are closer to the truth than the news. The news, by definition, reports the exceptional. If you read about it in the papers, you can bet your life it rarely happens. And every case that goes to Switzerland is reported in peace. That's terrible, isn't it? All these people going to Switzerland. It's not all these people. It's an extremely rare event. But you see, what happens then is the opinion pollsters take an opinion. They say, oh, yeah, we should change the law. The opinion pollsters publish the opinion poll, and people read it, and they say, oh, people are saying we should change the law. That's my view. We should change the law. There's information recycling going on. Some years ago, it was about 3 or 4 years ago, I read an article in the, I think it was the Telegraph or the Times, and it said an opinion poll showed that 70% of people believed that the army didn't have enough helicopters in Afghanistan. And I sat back and I thought, how could they possibly know? And then I remembered that the papers have been saying for the last 6 months the army hasn't got enough helicopters in Afghanistan. You see what happens? The media report it, the opinion pollsters take your view, they report the view of the public, and the public say, yeah, that's my view. It just goes around in circles. And then what about polls on other subjects? What about polls on immigration? What about polls on capital punishment? You can bet your life. You know, these are knee-jerk reactions. This is a similar one. If it's about compassion and human interest, they will go one way. But what's going on under the surface? We're getting to the deep stuff now. I've got 10 minutes, haven't I? Good. We're getting to the deep stuff. What's going on under the surface? We live in an age of choice. I was at the heart of this revolution, I'm slightly ashamed to say. I was working in Whitehall in the mid-1980s when choice came onto the agenda. I thought it was wonderful. I used to quote those words to myself of William Wordsworth, you know, bliss was it in that dawn to be alive. We're remaking, like we're giving everyone choices of all kinds of things. Yes, choice is fine, but it's migrated from the economic field into the ethical field. Choice, for some people, particularly the well-heeled, the well-educated, is splendid. I went to my doctor a few years ago and was diagnosed needing a minor operation. And he said, okay, which hospital do you want to go to? I said, a good one? How could I possibly know? You know, for most people, for most of the time, choice is actually a burden. I'm not trying to withdraw choice from people, but we are rather obsessed by it these days. And also, politicians love choice. It's a way of avoiding responsibility. If you give people choice and things go wrong, it's your fault, you chose it. I'm being cynical, but, you know, who would be cynical about politicians? And then there's the aging of the baby boomers, of which I am one. We've had it all our own way, all our lives. I had a free grammar school education. I came out of university, no tuition fees, no student loans. When I came out of university in the 1960s, it was guaranteed entry into the professions. I've got a final salary index-linked pension. I've even got a bus pass. But I'm afraid that my generation is now reaching old age. And we're coming up against something we can't quite handle. It's called death and dying. And we want somebody to put it right for us. A lot of the pressure, actually, is people in the sort of 50 to 80 bracket here. This is a mess that the youngsters have to clear up one day. And then there's what I've called here the devil take the hindmost approach to living. I think that though we actually live in quite a cruel society today, crueler than it was 20 or 30 years ago. In many ways, it's better. It's more prosperous. It's, in some respects, easier. It's easier for you if you know what you're doing, if you know which buttons to press. I really do not envy people who don't have those capabilities. You know, when something goes wrong in my life, I can very easily draft a letter to the local council and persuade them to do something else. A lot of people can't do that. we do live in this an age when you've got the choices, you ought to be able to do it. And then there's the notion which underlies much of this subject: what I want is what everyone should have. You know, I want to be able to end my life on my terms, when I want, in just the way I want, so why can't we have a law? The trouble is, when you make a law, you don't just make it for me, you make it for everybody. That's the problem, really. Laws are there for everybody. And why is it happening now? When I was a boy, and, you know, the older I get, the more often I use that phrase. It's quite depressing, really. I used to hear my father doing it. When I was a boy in the 1950s, people really did die in pain. I can remember my parents talking about the suffering of people who died. Nobody talked about legalising administered euthanasia or assisted suicide. Nowadays, pain is much less of a problem than it was. Medical science has advanced hugely, and yet these demands are happening. The thing has happened in a complete inverse ratio. Why is it happening? It's happening for several reasons. One, I think, is rising prosperity. When I'm talking to young audiences in universities, I say to them, and they look at me incredulously, I said, I have to tell you that everybody, just about everybody, is fabulously more wealthy now than they were 50 years ago. I mean, there are exceptions, but most people are very much more wealthy. Rising prosperity gives an illusion of control. When we are prosperous, we are more in control of our lives. We feel we should be in control of our lives. We don't want to be dependent on other people. And the corollary of that is we don't want other people to be dependent on us. There's been a breakdown of family ties. My generation started this. Previous generations in my family had all worked locally in Lancashire, where I was brought up. I went away to university, first generation. There weren't any jobs where I was brought up. First to Norfolk, then to London. It's happening all over the place. Now, everybody is going to where the jobs are, and the families are breaking up as a result of that. We're getting lots and lots of mother, father, one or two children, and single-parent families. It's breaking up even further. So the sort of self-help, the cohesion of family life has broken down. We have a sense of increased individualism, the notion that as individuals we should be in control, we should be able to do what we want. And then there is technological change. Never underestimate this. Just think about it for a moment. How many of us now travel by train rather than by car? We have our own personal transport. We don't even have phones that are linked to our houses. We have a personal phone. We don't go to concerts. We put headphones on. We listen to iPhones. So much of the things we do now actually are done individually rather than collectively. Look at the streets at night. Nobody on the streets. One of the reasons there's so much crime, actually, is there aren't enough people on the streets. Because people are at home doing things individually rather than collectively. Technology has had a huge impact there. And what about where it's been tried? 5 minutes, and I'll be there. Okay. What about where it's been tried? In the recent debate in the House of Lords, Lord Falcon, who's sponsoring the assisted dying bill, said there has been no evidence of abuse in Oregon since the inception of the law. He's right, there hasn't been any evidence of abuse, but there's a very good reason for that. There's no reporting system. You wouldn't know whether there's any abuse. All that a doctor has to do is fill in a form. Nobody investigates it to see whether it's been carried out in accordance with the law, so you can quite truthfully say there's no evidence of abuse. The important word there is evidence, not abuse. There is, in Oregon, a rising death rate. There are now 4.5 to 5 times as many assisted suicides as when the law came into force in the late 1990s. I've mentioned undiagnosed clinical depression. And there is this phenomenon known as doctor shopping, and I've touched on this briefly, that 2 out of 3 people in Oregon go to their doctors and say, sorry, I don't do that sort of thing, it's not compatible with medicine. So they are vectored onto compliant doctors by local pressure groups. They say, yeah, we'll find a doctor for you. We'll find a doctor. But it'll be a doctor who doesn't know anything about you. The death rate is rising. The death rate in 2013 in Oregon, if we had that in England and Wales, is 1,150 physician-assisted suicides a year. And then neighbouring Washington State, this is not Washington, D.C., this is Washington State, capital Seattle, neighbouring to Washington. The death rate is going up rather more sharply. And when people are asked why they go for assisted suicide, 61% of them in 2013 said, because I don't want to be a burden on other people. Pain comes very low down on the list. Doctors can deal with pain. And then there's the Netherlands and Belgium. You probably read about more than this in the press. They have legalised not just assisted suicide, they've legalised administered euthanasia. This is the much more virulent form of the virus. If we had Holland's law here, we'd be looking at around 17,000 deaths a year from this, just in England and Wales alone. But the campaign said, that's euthanasia. We're not dealing with euthanasia. We're dealing only with assisted suicide. But it's the same type of legislation. It's vaguely worded laws which are subject to elastic interpretation once they're on the statute book. And also on arbitrary criteria. I mean, terminal illness is an arbitrary criteria when you think about it. If you are suffering, why should it make any difference whether you've got less than 6 months to live to have assisted suicide? I mean, there are people with distressing conditions who live with them for years. The criterion doesn't actually make sense. And when you have an arbitrary criterion, it's easily expanded. And then there's ethics. On the one side, you can say there is an ethical case for this. It's called compassion. But compassion for whom? It may be compassion for a minority of strong-minded people, but what about vulnerable people? What about people who are subject to pressures from others? And on the other side, there's the theme of sanctity of life, sanctity of human life. We do not take human lives. This is a theme which the law develops. But then, of course, you can say, yes, but whose life is it? Faith-based ethics. Some questions here. In a civil society, does the law have to reflect what the churches teach? Now, I think most of us would actually say no. I mean, otherwise, adultery would be illegal. I mean, the churches, I'm sure you do, but I'm looking at the other churches too. The churches do actually teach that adultery is wrong. But should we criminalise it? Probably not. The opinion polls tell us that people who go to church believe we should change the law. Majorities of people go to church. But the churches say, no, you shouldn't. Is there a conflict between what the churches are saying and what their adherents are saying? There probably is. Why is that conflict there? Well, churchgoers are not a separate caste. They're the same as the rest of us. They read the same papers. They tune into the same radio and television stations. They're subject to the same propaganda. Are the churches imposing their views on society? This is one of the accusations that is made. It's particularly the case because the Church of England has 26 bishops in the House of Lords. And some of them turn up to vote on this particular issue. And they tend to vote against it. Therefore, we're being told the churches are imposing their views. No, they're not imposing their views. They're expressing a view. They can't force anyone to do this. So what role should the churches play in the debate? The churches have a duty to teach their adherents. That is what they should be doing and expressing a public view on this. And that is what they are doing. Now, finally, this is my last slide, you'll be delighted to know. Some questions to ponder. Would we seriously consider doing this with any other law? Now, I've drawn the parallel of the man who breaks into the house, the intruder. It's a valid one here. There was a case actually in Norfolk some years ago. I can't remember his surname now. A man found an intruder and he shot him and killed him. And you say, well, would we change the law to say if somebody burgles your house between these hours, you can kill them with impunity? No, we wouldn't. If somebody did that, would we say you should definitely go to prison? No, wouldn't. What we would say, and it's exactly what happens, is if that happens, we'll look at the circumstances and see whether a case can be made for withholding prosecution or not. Second question, is legalisation an issue of principle or of specifics? I'm often asked this question. When I do university debates, people say, are you against changing the law in principle, or is it just this particular law you don't know? The answer is both. I'm against it on principle, not specifically religious principle. There is one principle that bothers me. I'm worried about licensing for some people in some circumstances acts that are regarded as criminal for the rest of us. Again, it links with the first question. I don't think I would do this with any other law. Why should we do it with this one? But I'm also against this on specifics as well. The bills that we've seen at Westminster and Holyrood haven't made the slightest attempt. They haven't made the slightest attempt to build serious safeguards. That is puzzling an awful lot of us, actually. They just said, oh, just generalities. Vote on the principle, we'll deal with the details later. You can't do that. This is a serious issue of public safety. Where is the evidence that the law as it stands isn't suitable? This is a question that's completely glossed over. There is no such evidence. The law deters malicious action. It keeps the number of cases of assisted suicide down to a bare minimum. And it also has the discretion to deal sensitively where sensitivity is needed. And would an assisted suicide law be an improvement? It's hard to see how. I'm willing to look at any bill that is seriously drafted, but I haven't seen one yet. Now, I think I'm just about within my time, and I'll finish at that point.
Thank you.